Lots of police officers listening to our program every night. They're going to get a kick out of tonight, and so will you as we talk about some true tales of law enforcement encounters with the paranormal and the unusual, the strange. In a moment, Paul Ramosh joins us, Fingerprints and Phantoms on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our guest, Paul Ramosh, graduated from Weber State University in Ogden, Utah, with a bachelor's degree in forensic science, a minor in photography. Now, that was back in 1997, and a master's in criminal justice in 2019. He has worked as a crime scene investigator for the Weber Metro CSI for the past 23 years. Three-time recipient of the Weber County Sheriff's Office Medal of Merit. Paul has certifications through the International Association for Investigations in Fingerprint Examination and Forensic Photography, currently serving as Utah's representative to the Western Identification Network, Latin's Fingerprint Committee. His latest book, Fingerprints and Phantoms. Paul, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, great, George. It's so good to be back with you.
How did a law enforcement expert like you get involved in investigating the paranormal?
Well, that's a really good question, and sometimes I sit and wonder that myself. But, I mean, it basically comes down to the fact that in law enforcement, one of the things I really enjoy about this profession is the storytelling that goes on. And on TV, forensic shows or police story or shows, everything's always exciting and it's always go, go, go. And while there is that element in real law enforcement, there is a lot of downtime. And so there's plenty of time sitting at court waiting to testify or sitting outside of a scene waiting for a search warrant to be signed. Or there's just a lot of downtime. And so there's a lot of storytelling that goes on. And a few years ago, I guess it's probably been about 10 years ago, around Halloween, I love Halloween. I love campfire stories. I love folklore. And so around Halloween, I just started to ask some of the officers and fellow CSIs that I interacted with if they had ever had any ghost stories, anything spooky.
Uh-huh.
And I was just surprised to hear that a lot of them had. And in fact, a big majority of them had something. And so I collected some of these stories. And then after a while, my wife was like, hey, you should write them down in a book. They're really good stories. And so, I just started to write them down. But mainly it started as just kind of a collection of stories and folklore almost.
Well, you've done a great job with your works. That's for sure. You were last on with me about 3 years ago. Remember?
Oh, has it been that long?
You had not gotten your master's degree at that time. You got it a year later.
Yeah, that was a busy time. I'm glad it's done.
I had a law enforcement call several years ago. We were just talking about the paranormal, and we have a lot of police officers who listen to the show. We also have a lot of inmates in prisons who listen to the show right now, Paul. But when officer called me, he said that they had a call. It was a 911 call that somebody was having a heart attack, and we got there before the first responders got there. We got there before the EMT. We get to the door, and a little man opens the door for us to let us in. So we come running in, and there's another little old man lying on his face on the floor. We roll him over, and it's the little old man who opened the door. How does that happen?
Well, it's interesting. When people in law enforcement, police officers, paramedics, crime scene people, we are around death a lot. I mean, sometimes every day. I mean, I work in a smaller city where there's not tons of murders and things like that every day. But, there's always death calls that you go on. And when you're around these things so much, you just start to experience them. And like I said, when I started to gather these stories, I was surprised how often police officers and crime scene people had these different things happen to them. And so as to, you know, that particular story, how it happened, that's the age-old question, isn't it?
Exactly.
That's the question we'd all like to know.
What have things been like during the pandemic for law enforcement? Not easy.
Well, what was that?
Not easy, I bet.
No, it was hard. When everything first went down, there was a lot of uncertainty and, you know, some anxiety and things like that. But I mean, we're in law enforcement. I mean, we're used to dealing with infectious diseases all the time anyway. And so, we took precautions, you know, we got vaccinated when it came out, but yeah, it was a little bit of a nerve-wracking time, especially in the beginning. And it's been interesting. I've heard different people say this. I haven't seen any really good numbers on it. I think anecdotally, this has been the case here in my neck of the woods. But it seems like for us, property crimes went down, but domestic violences and kind of interpersonal crimes
went up. They went up, yeah.
Yeah, and it's you know, no wonder. A lot of people are out of work, and a lot of people are forced to be together 24/7 that normally weren't. And so, yeah, I think the stress levels have gone up. And it will be interesting because stress can actually change a person, change them physically.
Oh, dramatically, physically and mentally, of course.
Right. Yeah, and it even kind of can change you, change your genetics almost. I remember reading a story about the kids who were in Holland during the Nazi occupation and suffered a couple winters of near starvation. It actually, that stress that they went through changed them and kind of had generational effects. And so you wonder, I mean, the kids now, so many young people had their, you know, their school kind of ripped out from under them. A lot of them were really afraid. So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see even years down the road what effect this all has had on, will have on people.
Your book is 26 chapters, and let's go through some of these, and then we'll get back into some heavy questions with you, Paul, too. How did you develop the book in terms of the chapters?
Well, the way I tried to structure it a little bit is that each chapter has a ghost story or a weird or a paranormal story like that, but it also starts out, the first part of the chapter has a little bit of what you could call maybe law enforcement insider information on there, or just kind of some of my thoughts about the job. And that transitions into the story. And so, like, for example, a lot of things happen to officers. Interesting things happen to them when they're parked at a cemetery at night. And the question might arise, well, why is it that the police even will go to a cemetery at night and park it? That doesn't seem a logical thing to do, and most people would stay away from it. But, you know, I explained in the book that a police officer is never really off the clock when they're in their car and they're in their uniform. And there's a funny meme that you see going around Facebook sometime of, it's like two elderly people and they're smiling and pointing and they're saying, oh, look, there's a police officer. Let's go tell him about something that happened 26 years ago. And it just happens that, you know, an officer will, if he pulls in a parking lot of a grocery store to eat a sandwich for lunch, even though he's on his lunch break, people will want to go, hey, you know, report something or go talk to them. And so it's not uncommon that they will go to very secluded places to get caught up on paperwork or eat their sandwich or whatever. And one of those really secluded places are cemeteries. And so each chapter is designed a little bit like that, where I describe some parts of the job and then go into the stories. And, you know, I've tried to clump some stories together in, you know, different kind of genres or tropes, I guess is the term that kids use now, different tropes that, you know, cling together. But that's how the book is organized.
Now, how did you solicit again the stories that are in the book?
Well, just in that storytelling culture. So just when
word of mouth.
Yeah, as a crime scene investigator, we are at our office working on lab work or different things until a police officer calls us out for a call for service. He or she's on a call and they need us to do fingerprints or photographs mm-hmm. or evidence collection, something like that. And so just over the course of, you know, a couple years when I would go out on those calls for service, I would just say, hey, anything ever happened to you kind of weird? Or, you know, just bring the subject up. And most people were very forthcoming. Some, you know, acted a little bit weird. But then when they saw that I wasn't going to make fun of them, that I was genuinely interested in the subject, they would open up. So, yeah, just kind of over the course of several years, just talking to people, enjoying those fun stories that are such a good part of the job.
What do your colleagues say about the work?
Well, it's funny. Sometimes my coworkers are more ardent believers than I am, because I'm actually a little skeptical. I have a healthy dose of skepticism. I don't think every story you hear, every, you know, strange noise that you hear in the office is a ghost. And some of my coworkers, you know, they hear the roof pop and they're like, oh, look, there's the ghost. And so I'm actually a little bit more skeptical than them, but none of them think it's strange. None of the people I work with are opposed to my interest in this. And a lot of the stories from the book came from my coworkers. And so, yeah, it's fun. And you know, the way I look at it is that we're trained a certain way. We're trained to think a certain way as crime scene people. And it's a little bit opposite from the normal scientific method. And so in the scientific method that kids are taught in school and that kind of mainstream scientists have, they first have a theory, and then they do experimentation to see if they can prove their theory. And then once they've analyzed the data from their experimentation, then they decide whether that theory has been confirmed or not. Well, it's kind of a dangerous thing to go into an investigation with a theory already in mind. And the person who trained me, my mentor, his name's Rustin, he taught up at Weber State for years in their criminal justice department. He taught us to think from a more bottom-up approach. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, if you go into a crime scene with a preconceived notion, with a theory, then you could possibly be railroading an innocent person. Like
absolutely.
If you are latched onto them, or, you know, latched onto a certain theory, then that's trouble. And you can see countless examples where investigators picked out a suspect first suspect they had, you know, they were going to make things fit. Well, the proper way is to go into an investigation with no preconceived notion and just to look at the evidence and look at the evidence again and look at some more evidence. And as you go from that bottom-up approach, as you gather all the data that you can, at the end, you have your theory. So instead of starting with a theory, you end with that theory. And that, like I said, that's the way I was trained to think as a crime scene investigator. And Russ, he was amazing at it. In the years I worked with him, the dude was never wrong. You know, we would be as young investigators trying to have a theory or saying, oh, maybe this happened, maybe this happened. And he would be like, no, let's give it time, give it time. At the end, he would, you know, say what he thought happened. And the guy was never wrong. And, you know, the reason I tell you that is because so many of the topics on your show, when you take them to the mainstream or to kind of conventional thinking, they'll say, oh, no, that can't possibly happen. You know, I'm a scientist or whatever, and these things, you know, the afterlife or UFOs or whatever, these things can't happen. But as I've talked to people over the years and heard their stories and had different accounts from different people, I can't just exclude what they have to say out of hand. Because of that bottom-up approach to be just like, well, you know, these are the facts of the case, I can't exclude what they have to say. And so in that regard, I don't think that my profession or the way I look at things as a forensic scientist is really at odds with some of these paranormal experiences people have had, because, you know, who am I to tell them they didn't experience what they had? And in some cases, it's the best explanation for things.
Absolutely. After the break, Paul, I want to talk about some of the stories in your book that you've got and some of the strange ones and things like that. But what did you learn writing this book about law enforcement and the paranormal? What's that main message you picked up?
Well, what I learned is that there are some interesting kind of types if we just look at kind of ghostly experiences, there's some interesting categories that are there. And usually something that a person considers to be kind of ghostly fits nicely into one of these categories. And there are categories that I've heard paranormal researchers on your program talk about countless times. I mean, this isn't anything that I've come up with myself. But the stories that I've heard from different officers and different CSIs, they seem to nicely fit into that. And so one of the categories is kind of the tape recorder in stone category, where it seems like people are seeing something that's not necessarily a ghostly spirit acting autonomously. There's just some bit of energy or something that's just replaying that people see. And then there's another category of a loved one visiting a member of their family as they're on their way out of this realm. And then there's, you know, other categories where things are just kind of so bizarre that you can't necessarily explain them. But I've just seen, like, and like I said, I didn't necessarily set out to write this book as a treatise on the paranormal. I don't really consider myself a paranormal investigator, but this was more of an exercise in folklore. I love the stories, but it's hard to ignore some of those categories that these experiences fit into.
All right, good for you. And what is your website, by the way, Paul?
So I like to do all of my conversing with people through Facebook. And so my Facebook page for Fingerprints and Phantoms is Leaked on Coast to Coast, and that's what I use to converse with people.
All right, great. Paul Ramosh with us, his book, Fingerprints and Phantoms. We're going to talk about some of these incredible stories in here. And then the next hour, we're going to open up the phone lines for questions and stories. Do you think law enforcement, most of these are what, ghost stories? What are they?
Well, most of my stories do seem to kind of revolve around ghostly things, but they're, you know, I've heard over the years some encounters with Bigfoot that people have had. And then one of the weirdest stories in my book, it has kind of a shape-shifting element to it. And so, yeah, mostly it's ghosts, but there are some other type of stuff. Other types of experience.
All right, Paul, stay with us. Let's go through the book when we come back and talk about some of these incredible stories, including the strange ones. That's what I want to hear. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, along with Paul Ramosh. Paul, where do we get your books, Fingerprints and Phantoms? Still available on Amazon?
Yep, Amazon.com, and also Barnes & Noble and local bookstores can order it in. I mean, it's been out for a few years now, but they can order it in.
Super. Now, let's talk about some of the stories. Give us one or two. You're not going to do them all because that's your book, but give us a few of your favorite scary ones.
Well, like I said, there's experiences that people have that are not readily explainable. And sometimes, because of ghostly encounters, people even have a little bit of information about a crime that happened that they shouldn't. And one of my favorite stories from the book, and one of the earlier ones that I collected, it's one of the OG stories from the book, is there was a homicide that I investigated. I was part of the team early on in my career, and it was a bad one. It was a man and a woman who were getting divorced, and it was amicable for the first little bit, but then it turned violent, and unfortunately, that's a pretty common occurrence when interpersonal violence like that between married people when they're getting a divorce. Like, you're much more likely to be killed by somebody you know than a stranger, unfortunately. But this was a really bad homicide scene, and we went and investigated it, and we were there for days and days and days. And it's pretty much the practice as an investigator that you really don't want to change anything at the scene. If the TV's on, you leave it on. If the lights are off, you leave them off as long as you can. You in those first few days when you're really documenting and you know, trying to get a feel for what's going on, you don't want to change it. Change anything in the scene. Now, a weird thing in this scene is that there was a CD player that in this apartment where this poor unfortunate girl was, that was playing a song on repeat. And it was back in the days of CDs. This was early in my career. And you know, you could set a CD player to replay a song. You know, that wasn't that weird. But the song, the lyrics of the song, it was the song was Sweet Surrender by Sarah McLachlan.
Ah.
And beautiful song, love her. She's a great artist. But the words, as you listen to the words, they started to get a little, when you contemplated them, they started to get a little freaky for what we were dealing with. And the lyrics say, doesn't mean much, doesn't mean anything at all. The life I've left behind me is a cold room. And, you know, just when you hear that, your life I've left behind me, and you're seeing this poor murdered girl here, and it was just playing on repeat over and over and over again. And finally, a member of our team is like, can we turn that blankety blank CD player off? And we're like, yes, you know, let's do it. But anyway, we worked this scene, and this was one of those times when you could feel the presence of the murder victim there. And every single member of the crime scene team felt it. Like, when you were in that apartment, you could feel like the victim was there, her spirit. And it got so bad that, not bad, but it was just almost so commonplace that when we would go back day after day to that scene, we would say hello and then say the victim's name. We're here again. You know, you could just feel her. And it's, unless you've been in that circumstance, I know some people out there might be rolling their eyes, but, well, maybe not in this audience, but, you know, if you tell that story to a group of, you know, skeptical people, they'd be rolling your eyes. But if you weren't there, you can't say anything about it, right? Because we could just feel it. But anyway, we go and work the scene. You know, we're there every day for a couple weeks until we're all done, and then the scene is, you know, cleared and we're done. And so, you know, the case goes to court and all these things, and I just think it's done. You know, I put it behind me. Well, what's interesting is a couple years later, the apartment is cleaned up, patched up, and re-rented out to people. And an officer that I'm good friends with, his name's Mike, he received a call for service to go back to that apartment. And it was something pretty innocuous. It was like a juvenile disturbance or a noise complaint. I can't remember exactly now what it was, but it was just, you know, a pretty basic crime that he had to go take a report on. But he was one of the initial officers who discovered her. And so as he's going back to this apartment, you know, he feels a little anxious. You know, he's like returning to literally to the scene of the crime, not proverbial, but literally returning to the scene of the crime. But anyway, Mike's very professional. He goes in, he talks to this man and woman, and takes their report, and, you know, it's just pretty routine business. Well, all the, you know, he's done, he's getting ready to leave, and the lady, there's a man and a woman living there, and the lady goes, "Hey, officer, can you tell me, was someone murdered in these apartments?" And when she said that, Mike said he could feel the blood drain out of his face a little bit, and he's like, "Yeah, yes, ma'am, there was." And she's like, "Well, can you tell me which unit and, you know, which apartment?" And he said, "Well, are you sure you want to know?" And she goes, "Yeah." And he's like, "Well, this one." And the woman's husband was sitting on the couch and just nonchalantly says, "Well, that explains a few things." And then he just goes back to watching TV or whatever he was doing. Well, Mike's like, his curiosity's really peaked at this point. And so he's like, "Well, why did you ask? You know, and what did that comment mean?" And the people said, "Oh, well, it's kind of nothing. Every now and again, the hall light down at the end of the hall will turn on and off, and then the bathroom door will open by itself." And when Mike heard this, he really felt the hair on the back of his head up and the blood drained out. Because, and this is the interesting part, it was never out in the public or the media where exactly this girl was when she was killed. And the fact of the matter is that she was probably running down that hall to get away from her husband, and was sandwiched against the bathroom door. So she was probably trying to get in there to lock herself in and seek some sort of protection, but the door opened outward into the hall, and so she was sandwiched against it. And so what these people are describing is a particular element of this crime that's not out in the public. But people don't know this, but they're describing it. This door is the thing that opens up. And so, you know, that goes back to, you know, what we were talking about before the break, that, like, how did they know that? You know, that maybe they randomly guessed, you know, a skeptical person could find it, but they're talking about specific details. And what's interesting is, as I've gone back and thought about that case over the years, I've began to wonder about the CD player playing that same song over and over again, based on an experience that happened to one of my new coworkers just recently.
What happened there?
Well, it's interesting. And like I said, it makes me really reevaluate. For the crime that I was on, the murder, I just thought, well, that song was stuck on repeat. And you know, before she died, she was just listening to that song over and over again. Well, recently, and this is just within the last few months, or I guess maybe within the last year, my coworker named John was working on some evidence from a suspicious death that he was working on. And in it, there was a lot of questions about whether this woman was murdered or whether it was a suicide. It was just a real tough nut to crack. And so he had some of the evidence from the scene, and he had taken it back to our lab, and he was photographing it and examining it and seeing if there was any additional processing that needed to be done. And he, you know, took from evidence a shoe that had been in the room with this victim when she died. And so he was looking at the shoe, photographing it, you know, doing the things he had to do, and he had his Spotify playlist going. And he's a young guy, you know, he's not going to use CDs. He's never seen a CD before, but he has a Spotify playlist going. And there's this one song that pops on, and it's by a group called the Volbeat. I'd never heard of them. That just shows my age. Oh. But there, it's a song by this group called the Volbeat, and there's a line in it that says, "I'm counting all the," and then it says a bad word. I don't want to get
Can't say that on the radio. Beep.
Yeah, we're not going to say any bad words. If it says, "I'm counting all the blanks in the room, I'm not alone, I'm not alone, I'm not alone." So it repeats, this song repeats the phrase, "not alone, not alone, not alone," a few times. So, you know, this song comes up on the playlist. Now, John doesn't have it on shuffle. He doesn't have it on repeat or anything. But this song comes on, and then when it finishes, it starts over again. And he's like, that's a little odd. I didn't, you know, it's not on repeat. It's just playing. It's just kind of supposed to come up randomly. And so the song plays a second time, and he's still working on this shoe. Well, it ends the second time and starts again. And here's this, "I'm not alone, I'm not alone, I'm not alone." And at this point, he's getting a little, and he's not freaked out, but he's like, what is going on here? My Spotify playlist has never done this before. But he can't go and grab the phone right away because he had gloves on that were bloody. He didn't want to touch his phone with these bloody hands. And so it played the song again for the fourth time. And so at this point, he's like, what is going on here? So he peels off the gloves, and he goes, and he fast forwards through the end of the song, moves on to the other song, you know, the next song up on the list, reapplies his gloves, goes back to the evidence, and then when that song ends, it's the "I'm Not Alone" song starts playing again. And at this point, he's starting to be a little freaked out. He's like, what is going on here? And so he gets done with his shoe, and he packages it and starts working on some other evidence from the case that wasn't in the room with the victim. And his Spotify playlist is just behaving normally. And then he goes and takes another piece of evidence to work on that was in the room with the victim. And that song starts playing again. And so at this point, he's starting to get freaked out. And, you know, he finishes up for the night and goes home. And when he's telling me this story, I think, well, what was going on here? And I said, this has never happened before. And he's like, nope. And it's never happened since. He couldn't figure out why this song with the lyric, "I'm not alone, I'm not alone," kept playing. And then I started to think about my experiences back from the Sarah McLachlan song that says, "The life I've left behind me is a cold room." And so you just begin to wonder. And you hear, you know, various people on your program have talked about electronic anomalies that seem to be associated with hauntings and things. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's definitely something that makes you scratch your head. And, you know, is someone trying to communicate via that method? I don't know. But it certainly is interesting.
Paul, is Ogden a hotspot for paranormal activity?
You know, in the state of Utah, it seems to be. And a lot of it comes from the history of Ogden. So Ogden was a rough-and-tumble railroad town for years and years and years. In fact, the nickname for Ogden is Junction City, because you could not take a train from the West Coast to the East Coast without going through Ogden. So there was when the railroads were at their heyday, everything going east to west funneled through Ogden. And so it had, back in the day, it had lots of brothels and speakeasies and just a lot of different things going on. And supposedly, I don't know if this has been verified or not, but you hear this a lot, that supposedly Al Capone visited Ogden once and said, "Boy, this town even scares me."
Huh.
And so it was a rough town and a long and interesting history. And so as far as Utah goes, Ogden really does have more than its fair share of hauntings. And a lot of it seems to revolve around a street called 25th Street that was right by the railroad. There were tunnels that went from the train station under the road up onto 25th Street. And that's where, you know, like I said, there were speakeasies and brothels and all these different things, and just really wild. And so, yeah, one of the most haunted buildings in Ogden is, it was called the Hotel Ben Lomond for a long time, and now I think it's called the Bigelow Hotel. But if the guests or the fans out there Google Hotel Ben Lomond, they'll find a lot of interesting ghost stories from there. So, yeah, just because of the history, the rough and tumble nature of it, there does seem to be a lot of stuff associated with it.
All right, Paul, we're going to take a quick break and come back and take phone calls with you and talk more. I'll get a couple more stories out of your book, and we'll take calls, questions, and stories next on Coast to Coast AM.